welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well, staying healthy. Please remember, wash your hands regularly, wear a face mask in public, observe social distancing, and remain quarantined as much as possible. Be aware of the COVID-19 protocols where you are living, as these differ from country to country. My guest this week is Vedant Maharaj. He's an architect. He's the head of the Rebel Base Collective Architecture and Design Studio here in Johannesburg. We chatted actually a few weeks, it's probably even maybe 2 months ago. I hate to say that. Apologies, Vedant. And it just got kind of pushed back, and as I was trying to look for some more COVID-based discussions. And so I hope you have had a chance to listen to my recent episodes, discussions with Michael Sachs and Professor Shabir Mahdi, talking about the sort of financial and then the medical context of COVID in South Africa in particular. Vedant and I spoke about a number of things, including how the Design Collective, his creative team, are adapting to working in isolation. That has probably changed now since we had that discussion. But also, you know, how he got into architecture. He tells a little story, nice little story about how he walked into a building site and wanted to help the guys laying the bricks. We spoke also about the state of architecture in South Africa, the difficulty and challenges of changing the legacy of spatial apartheid, in particular the policy landscape of that debate. We also spoke about the evolving technology of sustainable materials and design, and touched a little then also on his master's thesis design project, which confronted the challenges of infrastructural and ecological design in the political and religious context of modern India. So please now enjoy my chat with Vedant.
Vedant, thanks for joining me this morning from your home. And locked down, I presume.
Yeah, absolutely locked down, but in paradise, so it's all good.
You've got kids in the house. How are they handling?
They're fine, I think. We're doing the e-learning thing with them at the moment, so they have to spend a bit of time doing work in the morning, but the rest of it's watching animations and playing PlayStation. And
yeah. How old are they?
Kick projects. Boys are 9 and 12.
Okay, yeah. So that's... yeah, that's maybe quite manageable. I think having teenagers might have been a different challenge, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so too. But it's good. It's we're surviving so far.
You're an architect by training, but it seems you do a lot of other things. And obviously, I'd like to. We're going to talk about that. But and me coming from a family of architects, both my sister and my dad. Architects. I'm obviously just intrigued in the whole profession and what it actually stands for. But you listed on your bio one of your fascinations, science fiction thrillers. And I was thinking last night, a lot of science fiction. I'm not a massive science fiction fundi, but it seems to me that a lot of science fiction through the ages has dealt with the rise of the machine or the rise of technology, perhaps a pandemic here or there, but never a future where people were confined to their homes or isolated from each other. I don't know. Can you put this COVID-19 into some kind of science fiction context?
No, I think there are some, there have been some science fiction things, not very good ones, sort of the B-grade ones are. Like Pandemic is one of them that that deals with it, like this virus attacking the world and then people going mad and then having to isolate. But it's more like the sort of the forced isolation for survival as communities, never really the isolation in one's own house. I don't think it would make for a very exciting sci-fi thriller. You know, everybody sitting at home.
Looking out over the balcony and waving at each other.
I think if we look, if we have to look at this pandemic and what we have to do, it's actually quite banal, sitting at home and trying to keep some sort of sanity as opposed to an Armageddon. And I think it would be quite boring because you wouldn't have any guns or weapons.
Or creatures or zombies, or creatures to, or sort of physical enemy.
There's nothing to fight, despite Donald Trump's idea that this is a war against something. And that we need the military to be involved. But,
well, I suppose the Americans need a war to contextualize anything, don't they? War on terror, a war on drugs, now a war on virus.
A war on a foreign virus. Because, you know, just for good measure, one has to throw that in there. So, but no, I think it's interesting because I was saying the other day, every once in a while I go through a binge of some kind of sci-fi thing or like a fantasy thriller sort of thing. And I've gotten into, again, into the Studio Ghibli movies, which are sort of the old Japanese animation stuff, like the real breakthrough things.
I'm not familiar with that. Sort of early anime, is that?
Yeah, like early anime. So all the Hayao Miyazaki movies, and they're quite interesting because they're complex in the human interaction of them, and it's been quite interesting to get into them now in this time because it's so much more about human engagement and the things you take for granted and the things that you don't see, and the war with oneself, which I think that this is probably a thing. Like if there was to be a sci-fi movie, it's really more like a psycho thriller or something. It's that like internal sort of war that we're all feeling at the moment. But yeah, I'm sure there are going to be movies that come out about this thing now in a way that we didn't think about it before.
I think there's going to be a whole lot of, I mean, psychologists and sociologists must be kind of thinking now's our time.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think everyone's. it's weird because it's this underlying unease about what's going to happen, in the world. You know, I think we're trying to be excited about it. As an idea, a potential opportunity to think about things differently, but it's very unpredictable. So I think that's the best time for people to bring it's the best period for incubation, I suppose.
And I suppose hopefully a chance to look at things a little differently. Or come up with some sort of alternative ways of existing. I mean, we're sitting here, my wife and I, and haven't really missed too much, you know. It's quite strange how we seem to have adapted fairly, I don't know, we'll see in a week's time how we're doing, but I don't want to count my chickens, but, just how you... I suppose you miss that physical contact with friends and things like that, but sort of from a material perspective, how quickly we've sort of adjusted to a new way of living.
Yeah, I suppose I think the thing there for us is that we have access to the creature comforts, you know, so it's not hard to be at home.
I think we have to put it in that context as well. I think
For other people, it's probably quite different. The idea of like you can't go out and see people, and that's really the only thing that you have in your space that makes you feel happy and good and alive is the sense of community. And I suppose in some contexts, it's that thing where if you take the sense of community away from a place and now you're in isolation in something that's not comfortable, I imagine that's actually, quite difficult in a lot of ways.
How was you're the head of a design company, an architectural company, Rebel Base Collective?
Yes, so it's Rebel Base Collective is a design studio. Predominant work is in architecture at the moment. That's more because it's my original field of work, but we are starting to do a lot more things in graphics. We're trying to change the way you view architecture, so we're doing a lot more animation and 3D visualization stuff around our work.
I saw that. Was that for the Johannesburg Country Club?
Yeah, we did some stuff for the Country Club, but most of our projects we now represent for our clients through animation.
Mm.
We're trying to get into a bit more virtual, like a more accessible version of virtual reality, so that people can immerse themselves in a building without having to build it, and starting to build more conceptual projects that people can get into.
I'm just thinking, like, from a work perspective, how are you adapting to that? Is it quite easy to kind of shift to a more online way of working from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still a little bit early days to tell. I've sort of been, it's just over a week now that we've been out of the office. It's a bit slower. It doesn't have the kind of pace that we usually, or energy that we usually design with. Mm. Doing it online, you can't just print out a bunch of pages together and then just start drawing all over them and brainstorming. Mm. But I think we've adapted pretty well just in terms of a transition. We're still very productive in terms of output. But it doesn't. Yeah, I think it's going to take a little while for us to catch the spirit of how we do it. I think it was going to take a little while. But yeah, I mean, I think we're quite fortunate to be in a profession where everyone in the office is pretty tech savvy. So we in Zoom meeting sharing things.
Yeah.
We can have crits with each other quite easily, and then put the work out. So we're quite fortunate there. It's really the physical, the making stuff, the construction stuff that we're obviously struggling with now, where we're off-site and there's nothing we can do about it because it's built. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it's a much quieter time for me, at least, in terms of what we'd usually be doing. It's a bit of a frustrating time because I quite enjoy the making part of everything, and you're not getting to do that. So,
and that sitting in a room with people and sort of bouncing ideas.
We can't bounce ideas. We can't.
Well, I suppose you can bounce ideas, but you don't get that sort of tactile, physical kind of sense of collaboration.
It's like the sort of like the freedom of being in the creative space. You don't have that, you know. Everybody's in their own time frame. Everybody's working in their capacity that they can at home. So, you know, it's not everybody has a printer lying around so that they can print stuff out and draw it and send a sketch through. But I think, I mean, as time goes by, we'll probably start to adapt to that. You know, if you ask me next week, we might have access, all of us might have access to a digital whiteboard where we start,
where we
draw with a little Wacom tablet.
Yeah.
So we can brainstorm on a screen.
Yeah.
Together. That's more likely going to happen in the next 2 weeks than not. So we'll see how it goes. Mm. Yeah. But I think it's sort of the teething stage now where you're still trying to find your grip.
Yeah. I want to just sort of go back, if I may, get a sense of your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Johannesburg.
Okay.
My parents were sort of the Johannesburg Rocky Street Yeovil pioneers back in the day. So I grew up in that environment with a lot of kind of artists and musicians and filmmakers and script writers that my dad would meet somewhere on his way to get goat's milk. and they were living in a car and would end up in our house. So we just always had this like like bustling creative space at home the whole time, with new people constantly like flitting in and out. Well, she was still sort of part of our like our family now.
What did they do? Your parents, your mum and dad.
My dad is in banking. He's a business analyst for Standard Bank. But he
sounds quite bohemian.
My dad, when he was younger, wanted to be an architect, and he was really good at art and painting. And I mean, we've still got some of his stuff that he painted when he was in high school, and I can't believe he was in high school. But when he came to Johannesburg, you know, I suppose as many people did from Natal, he got a job in at Liberty, and he just sort of grew from there.
He worked his way. Yeah.
Like, he got into programming and then became a master programmer, and then got into business analysis, and sort of he's kind of worked his way through like in the classic Johannesburg City of Gold story, where he came with the idea that something was going to happen, and with nothing but like 20 bucks in his pocket, which was a lot then, I suppose, but not enough to survive, and just built his life from there. And then my mom was a lawyer in Durban. And she came up, and she was the group legal advisor for Amaral, which became Reliant, which became African Banks, which became Ellerines, and she basically stayed in the same place for sort of 30 years or so. Probably 1999.
Okay. So that was really that sort of period when Rocky Street was the kind of
it was the
melting pot, I suppose, in a way, of a changing South Africa at that time. From the mid 80s to the mid 90s.
Yeah, it was. So that's where my dad. When I was born, we were in Plumridge. And then my parents moved into like a bigger flat in Yeovil a few years later. It was like, that was the time. That was the very hopeful Rainbow Nation
moment.
And I think, that's probably the base of the fascinations of all things. That's where it came from sort of music to, or making music to, trying to make art to, sort of being politically engaged. It all stemmed from there. In a funny way, I think things have changed so much, as if you meet my parents now, you'd never say that was the life that we came from. We then moved to Emerentia when I was about 10 or so.
Okay.
And they still live in Emerentia, and they have a really nice life, a relaxed, calm, chilled space. It's very
different.
Very chilled. Yeah. Very chilled, yeah.
So how did the architecture bug then bite?
My earliest sort of memory of it was that my dad had told me about this thing called architecture, and which was when I was very young. I was probably like 5 or 6 at the time, like architecture, and that he wanted to be an architect when he was younger. And I was like, okay. So it basically distilled down to what is it, you know? And he's like, well, it's how you make buildings. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And I used to love stuff like Lego or anything, like anything that I could find, anything to build anything with, whether it was like the old cardboard boxes for from tissues that you could turn into garages for your little cars, or you know, and then stacking them on top of each other to make this like 100-tier car garage. It is like, yeah, I mean, anything that I could get my hands to make things with, I would, you know. And it's, yeah, I suppose that's sort of where it started. But I think at that age, lots of things were clicking. Like I went from the time I was like 3, I wanted to be a chef. So I'd like just end up cooking things, like trying to make mealie meal porridge in an ice cream container on the stove, which didn't go well. you know, stuff like that. But it's just like sort of the fascination with like making things. And then when I started to read, my dad had a book called How It's Made. I think like every family had a copy of this book in my youth. And I was fascinated by that. And then I would read about like how buildings are made, or how cars are made, or how boats made, or a watch, or whatever. And I got really fascinated with the idea of buildings, like how buildings are made, how we live in them, like, because they were sort of the biggest things that you could see around you were these buildings. And then as I got a bit older, the fascination kind of grew, but it got like, it was, yeah, it stayed in the same strain of how it's made. And then it got into construction and builders and how they make buildings. It's like you see these guys, they're walking around and this building comes up, and they seemingly are just like moving around. They're throwing bricks, they're laying them, they're moving wheelbarrows, and all of a sudden there's this like uber technically complete building. And you think about like the hands and the people that make them. And I think at about sort of around age 14 or so, I was walking past the building site on my way back from school, and I was watching these guys like make this building and these cranes lifting stuff and guys like throwing bricks up 3 stories. And I just walked into the site and I asked the sort of the boss of the site if I could work there. And I don't know why, like I was just so fascinated. Every day I'd walk past and look at it, and I was like, actually, if I want to be an architect, which I started to sort of, in your mid-teens you start thinking, well, I've got to figure out what I'm going to do after school now. So what is it that I want to do? Like, what's my goal?
Right.
And then I thought like, yeah, I should become an architect. And the first sort of point for me for architecture wasn't actually design. It was
construction building. Interesting. Yeah.
It wasn't this sort of loose, like whimsical thing, not the way it is now, I suppose, for me, like where.
Well, you want to come to that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where it started. I just
so that's quite amazing. You were kind of set on it quite early.
Yeah, I think for as long as I can remember, the only thing I've really wanted to be is an architect, except when I was younger and I wanted to be a chef. And you know, that translates into pretty good meals every day. So.
I just want to get a sense from you. I mean, there's sort of, for me, 2 quite famous adages that relate to architecture. I think I've got them right. Louis Sullivan proclaimed or said, form follows function. I think that was his. And Mies van der Rohe, less is more.
Yes.
You don't see a lot of that around, it seems, today. Or do you? I mean, what is the state of architecture in South Africa in particular, would you say?
That's a loaded one.
I'm trying to, I suppose, understand how architecture is meant to or should relate to its surroundings, and how in South Africa I get a sense that it's a lot of, especially these large buildings that you see going up in, say, Rosebank or Sandton today, for example, and in certain parts of Cape Town, seem to just be sort of these pompous monuments to corporate greed.
Yeah, I think that's one part. I think I think South Africa's architectural landscape for me is it's complicated. There's sort of a polarity between the, if I had to just split them into two streams of thought. The one is that we are, as a profession internationally, we're quite sought after. South African architects are sought after, especially going into sort of big commercial projects, because we're highly capable. I think we're technically proficient in making buildings, and we can do the big Santa monuments. And that's sort of the one side of architecture. It's this, the expectation is that in that way you're just serving a client's need, and the client is the person with the body with money, and they need to make this building for their, with all their money, and you're going to be the person because you also need to earn money, or the group that needs to earn money, then you do this building. And I think that there's very little agency for instigating social change when you're in that space. It's a lot more about the security of your job. And that, it's not that I think that the architects who are doing it are incapable of creating social agency. I just think that there's a lot of pushback from a corporate, as in any sort of corporate space, is that the client with the money, who's the capitalist, wants what they want, and you have to sort of deliver on that thing. Otherwise, you lose the job.
Mm.
The other stream of architecture, which is in the country, and I think this sort of, this just predates what I'm going to call my generation of young, like, architects at the moment, are the social architects, who are constantly sort of like thinking and trying to make projects that are, I honestly think that a lot of it has to do with guilt, like a political guilt that's there, as opposed to like an urge to do it. Because, you know, in sort of post-94, you have these architects coming out of bits and things that are all politically savvy, and they all decide to stay, and they all kind of want to do these social projects. So the community centers and the hospitals and the schools, and there are lots of, there are some really good examples of these buildings. And I think those, the ones who are really successful, somehow managed to get into museums. And those sort of big government buildings, and they, in a funny way, are equally, and for different reasons, as pompous as the Sandton buildings or the Rosebank sort of corporate buildings, because there's this idea of sort of flexing your creativity. But what I think in that sort of social architect world, there was a lot of weakness that was developed in not being able to fight for the right thing. There was sort of guilt, and people that were like wanting to make these big social changes, but they didn't have the sort of energy that the corporate architects had, in a way. And as a result, it sort of became, as well, what I think, like a quite a weak profession in that way, where these sort of social architects are doing small projects and aren't really like breaching the point of scale into making like the biggest statements or the biggest solutions for society. I think there's like a bit of fear built in there. And I think as a profession, the common denominator around those is that it fundamentally just like weakened the profession over time, to a point where people started to undercut fees, and it became this like corporate competition, and the smaller firms couldn't really do anything anymore, and they were losing work and losing jobs. And architecture then, like in terms of like the small architects who were socially minded, then started to have to shut down their firms and started to move into the big corporate things, and never like really, there wasn't a space of design integrity and social integrity in South Africa that was allowed to kind of breathe post 94 into that space. It was just like capital was there, people needed to build buildings, corporations wanted to grow, they did that, and then there were architects who were willing to do that. And funny way, they're the architects who survived. So it's almost like whether there was agency or want or not to kind of create better buildings and more socially conscious buildings. They didn't really get to a point where they did that. They just had to survive, and those are the firms that survive now, despite actually making decisions that made the profession quite weak. I don't know. I kind of spoke around that one a little bit. But.
No, that's. I'm just trying to sort of get to, I suppose, the role of architecture in transforming the post-apartheid, particularly urban landscape, and sort of the lack of that transition so far since 1994. There seems to have been either a disdain for transforming the sort of spatial apartheid of our cities in particular, but also a kind of missed opportunity in a way by both the state and urban planners and architects to come up with imaginative ideas to transform our cities.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things is that it's a very difficult sort of terrain to navigate. You know, the architects of apartheid were, they were terrible geniuses who...
You're not talking about architects here, you're talking about bureaucrats.
I'm talking about the ones who sort of created the system that we have to design the system, the systematic oppressors, who created this thing that's actually quite difficult to undo. And there's so many challenges that come with. So if you want to sort of connect people, let's say, or bring life into the inner city, people that were put into the townships have built their lives in the townships. You know, they choose to be there because that's also their family. That's also the space they've grown. They have created communities and societies that look after each other in that space. And then you have this sort of global idea of like, well, let's densify our cities. Let's densify the inner city and bring that in, which is sort of like the utopian idea of like when modernist Johannesburg was built, everybody would live and work in this place, and now it's transformed. And I think the solutions that we come up with are met with so many more challenges as you find the solutions that it's quite a difficult task to be able to get right, I think, in a way. But notwithstanding that, is that I think that in these creative fields, the idea of collaboration is something that's just a sort of like a buzzword in our fields, because it's actually, I think the bigger problem with finding the solutions together is that people aren't willing to collaborate. It's that they have, there's a lot of sort of creative ego that happens in these fields. And I think it's completely understandable in a way. It's, you know, it's your creation. You're an architect, like your piece of art, or you're an urban designer. But people don't quite know how to speak to each other and actually work together. Is I think the main issue in sort of finding that problem or that solution, or a series of solutions that you can implement, and also to, you know, you kind of pull together not just knowledge but resources, and you may even find that you can get the financial backing to do these things, but things are constantly working against each other, and I think the big thing in there is that it's also around policy, and policy is a very messy place to work in for architects or urban designers or sort of creative people, because policy has a lot to do with politics, and you know, you're really swimming upstream when you're trying to change policy. We've been dealing now with the new Johannesburg spatial development framework, or the nodal review that the city is trying to implement. And you see the sort of the city has a mandate to do something, and then they put it out, they create a solution or a plan, and they implement that plan without anybody else knowing about it. And then you have to fight to even have a voice in that thing. But the plan that they come up with is relatively unintelligible. It's because something worked somewhere in Europe or somewhere else.
Mm.
And they bring that plan, then they just sort of overlay it onto Johannesburg. And, you know, they cut it up into little blocks. And that's how they decide what the new urban framework is going to be like, without taking into context the fact that we have kopjes that are protected, and ridges and, you know, sloped areas that you can't build on. You can't zone this thing for hospitals. You can't build on there. You know, it's a protected conservation area or something.
But also, and
you actually then have to go into, you actually have to go into policy and into that space to create that change. So there's a lot of, there's so many points of collaboration that needs to happen. In order to make those solutions sort of come to life and to create, to write a policy around these big corporate buildings, that the bottom of those buildings has to make way for public space, has to engage in the street, has to, those are the sorts of things that we need to do, is you have to put it into legislation to say, like, this is what we're doing. This is what your building has to do if it's going to be built here. It's the only way to change it, because then it's not about the architect fighting with the client. It's just about saying, this is the rule. You have to do this. So it's almost like in a sort of communist way, you have to like make the rule, you have to follow the rule, and that's what it is. Like, that's why you can, that's the only way you can build. It's complex, sort of swimming around it, I suppose.
Well, I think having guidelines is not such a bad thing if it's, as you say, is aimed at some kind of transformative thinking about architecture and how it relates to its surroundings. But you know, you're talking about sort of imposition of ideas, etc., onto a city, cityscape. I think that this whole sort of current topic of smart cities is one of those, isn't it? You know, where you have this vision of a Johannesburg with this integrated transport and everyone's connected, and you just like, I mean, you just wonder how much of that is based on any kind of appreciation for local conditions, local circumstances, etc. I mean, it's all good and well to have those, I think, some of those aims, but just seems a little far removed.
Yeah, I think the big mistake, but it's and I don't think it's specific to South Africa. I think very much an international thing, is that detached people are coming up with the solutions. People who don't understand what the actual challenges on the ground are trying to come up with solutions. I think there's some excellent examples like internationally as well. I mean, like, if you look at India, it's the same thing. It's just this big move for these uber smart cities, you know. And there's like a big thing of like, let's roll out lots of toilets. Let's sort of roll out data points. Let's roll out 5G. Let's roll out technology, but I think all of these solutions miss a huge point. It's one of the points that we try to deal with a lot, is personal agency in any of that. Is that how is someone going to be able to take ownership of this? How is someone going to be able to be involved in this? How are you going to get someone to help themselves? Because there isn't capacity to create all of these things that you need to create for the solutions. You need people to be able to create those things themselves. But in order for people to create that thing themselves, you actually need to speak to them and engage with them and see what it is that they actually need. You know, we're talking about sort of like how are we going to get like data and online education and all of these things going in South Africa now. But you're not saying, well, do people have access to this? Do they even know how to use it? Where's the platform for education in this thing in the first place? Is this what they want? Like, is this the first need, or is this the need that's coming seventh or eighth in the list? Like, first you've got to make sure that people have food security. Then you've got to make sure that they have a secure home. You've got to make sure that they have access to basic facilities. And you have to make sure they have access to education before you can even start talking about digital education. You know, it's like, but it's sort of this big push with the government now to say, well, all, everyone must have iPads or tablets, must be learning on tablets in schools. I don't know if you'd seen, so I think it was earlier at the beginning of the year. There's this move for all children to have tablets in schools. I mean, like, all children don't have basic facilities. They don't have books to write in, and have pens. Like, there's the basic thing, but it's a huge thing in politics, and global politics is a big cause of this, which is that there's this constant competition to showcase how well your economy is doing, how well you're doing as a country, that there isn't the sensitivity in dealing with everyday people and what their actual needs are. And how do you grow those communities into a point where these new digital solutions and things are something that they start to feel like they need, because that's their own idea of progress. But if you keep having a detached view of these things, you're not going to get anywhere. And it's, I think it's everywhere in the world. I don't think that there are really places, you know, that, especially in developing countries, that have found the way to do this the right way. You know, and that's the thing, is I suppose when you're trying to showcase something, you forget that the people who are impacted involved by this showcase.
It sort of leads us in nicely, I think, to a discussion around your master's thesis, which was centered around the, do I say Ganga or Ganges? I wasn't quite sure.
The Ganga.
Ganga River in India.
Yeah.
You know, I had a couple of weeks back, I had Dr. Jackie King. She's an aquatic ecologist. She works a lot with rivers. They had a really great discussion, and we were talking about the Mekong River and, you know, 60 million people kind of living in and around it off the river. In India, you say it's like 500 million people who have some kind of either physical, economic, or religious connection to the river. What is the sort of basis of your thesis, and how did you kind of choose the Ganga as the sort of centerpiece for your master's?
That's a good question. When I was looking at it, the sort of topic of what do you do in your thesis, you know, it's like, it's a very serious thing in architecture school. So what are you going to do for your thesis? And you build up for sort of 6 years. There's this idea that you're going to end your academic career and your thesis, and it has to be the sort of the best thing you're ever going to do. And that you have to kind of do really well and sort of beat everybody else. And, you know, there's this sort of prize, this Korobik thing that everybody sort of shoots for. And it was interesting. I kind of went an opposite way, and I made a little list for myself with what I wanted this thesis to be. And I can remember some of the sort of like the points in this list. The one was that it had to deal with a global problem. There had to be something, it had to be global. It couldn't just be like a soft sort of, not soft, but like I wasn't gonna just try and make like a big fancy art school with offices above it, or like a commercial building or something like that as my proposal. It had to deal with a global problem that we're looking at in the world, and something that means something to humankind. And the other one was that it had to be for people. It wasn't a private building. It had to be a public thing. It had to be for people. And it had to deal with some kind of environmental or ecological component to it. And that fundamentally, at the end of it all, it had to come together into something that was just really beautiful. I had to find a beautiful solution so that people would want to use it if it hypothetically ever had to be built. So those were sort of the outlining laws for what I was thinking about. Yeah. Something to come back to if I ever was lost. And you get very lost in your master's thesis. It's a lot of fun, actually. And then I started to research around all these global problems, politics, all sorts of things. And the base for my thesis actually started in Lagos. I started looking at Lagos and the issues around sanitation and water. And I was specifically looking at the water cities. So
the water amazing things.
Like Makoko, which is interesting because I'm now making my students research Makoko. But I started looking at Lagos and what was happening in Lagos and the politics around it and water, and just like this idea of water. And then I stumbled upon this article about the Ganga and Modi and Modi's big push to clean the Ganga, and his sort of at that point in time there was like this political statement called Namami Gange, which is obeisance to the Ganga. And I was like, that's such a funny way to title this movement, like to obey something. I started to do a little bit more reading, and it's something that I do often. I'll find one fascinating thing and I'll become completely obsessed about it and then start reading everything that I can. and then I saw that he had started this movement to clean the river in Varanasi. And then I looked at this map and I was like, why is he starting in the middle of the river? Like, why is he making this the point for departure? And then all the other things started to come into play with, like, oh, wait, this is like a huge political move and how it's going. And then I just decided, well, this is it. This is what I'm going to do my thesis on. I'm going to go to India and I'm going to go to the site in Varanasi. And I'm going to start taking these constraints around what it is, like how do you clean the river from the middle of the river? that sort of led to, but it was this thing. And I must be honest, at the beginning of my thesis or at the beginning of my research, I was like, wow, this Modi guy, what an amazing character, like what a leader, like cleaning this river and like, look at how great it is, what an icon of a president, or prime minister. And then you start to dig into it. But that was sort of the departure point, was I found an article and then it just became more and more fascinating. So I decided, well, this is gonna be it. And I suppose in a way it's funny because I didn't take my I was quite serious about working to this idea, but I didn't take my thesis too seriously, which is kind of funny to say now, because I wasn't trying to do, it wasn't an academic exercise for me. It was just this exercise of, let's just do something that's going to be fun. Let's just see where it goes. Maybe you mess it up completely, and that's fine, But if you fundamentally have something beautiful at the end, whether anyone likes it or not, doesn't really matter because, architects are aesthetists, and if you do nice drawings, then you're not going to fail. So what do you have to lose? And that was basically it. I just sort of, I did it because it was there.
What is Modi trying to do with that? Is it a kind of religio or Hindu nationalist project to sort of cut off people from the Ganges as opposed to cleaning the Ganga? Restrict access to it on a religious basis, or what is he?
I don't know if this project in particular is the project of Modi's agenda, or the Hindu nationalist agenda rather, but what was quite clear from researching it is that it's very much a political move. It's got nothing to really do, I think, with cleaning the river. Mm. For me, it had a lot to do with cleaning the river, but I think that it doesn't really have a lot to do with cleaning the river. It has to look like the river is being cleaned, because then it looks like there's progress. But I think the actual ecological change is not that important. But what it is important, and the reason why he started in a place like Varanasi now, Varanasi is the city of Shiva. It's arguably the holiest city to Hinduism, you know, with sort of competing with like maybe Rishikesh kind of thing, but it's one of the holiest cities, undoubtedly the holiest city. And it's Shiva's city. So Shiva is the kind of the rock star, I would say, of the Hindu triad. And it's also the city of cremation. So it's the city of death, right, where you go to die. And I don't know how much sort of knowledge you have around it. But in Hinduism, when you die, or the idea is that when you die, you, through all of your incarnations, you eventually reach a point in your death of enlightenment called moksha. And it's believed that if you are cremated in Varanasi, that you will reach moksha. If you die in Varanasi, you will reach enlightenment. And so it's the city of cremation, and the cremations happen on the bank of the river.
Yes, I've seen pictures of
these areas called ghats, which are basically steps, the step areas. But you have cremation ghats. There's two main ones in Varanasi, and in theory the cremation flames, or the flames of the fires that are used for cremations, have been burning for millennia. You know, it's like an undying fire that they've kept going now for generations, centuries, millennia. Varanasi, like in its oldest form, is as far back as you can date, is about 4,500 years old.
Sure.
And the theory is that, so that's where Shiva came to reside, because, you know, you look at it now and kind of obvious, the symbol that humans can see in that it's shaped like a snake. It says that the water flows upwards, but in the big picture of, or instead of the, like the river flows the wrong direction, but in the big picture, it's actually because of gravity. If you take the long line of the river bends up, because it's just doing a curve.
Right.
But it's the idea that Shiva is there is because the river flows out of Shiva's head. And that's why the river in this area flows upwards, kind of thing. So there's a lot of symbolism loaded around this particular site for Hindu people. And if you look at Modi's sort of moves, which are a lot less subtle now, that there is a strong idea around the Hindu nationalist movement I don't know if it's fair to say Modi, but at least in the BJP, there's this huge movement for Hindu nationalist stuff and an anti-Islamic way and a thing. So there's this latching on to religious symbology that moves people, is in that or moves Hindu people in India and kind of propels them to doing things or saying things or thinking things that they weren't necessarily thinking before, because now all of a sudden there's almost like this threat on a religion or a symbol through their religion, which is quite powerful. I mean, you know, it's not the first time in history that it's been used, but it's, I think the scale is unprecedented in a way. But yeah, so I think there's that's what fascinated me a lot about it, was how this religious symbol is being used for a political thing. And I think from my end was saying, well, given that all of these things are constrained, so those all became like factors that I took as fact. I was like, okay, so this is being used as a religious like tool. This is being used as a political tool. How do you still make a building that's for everybody, even in that space? How can you like create a building and sell it? So it's like trying to make something subversive, but without people really knowing what it is. Yeah, I suppose.
Well, that's classic, yeah. But Dan, we're running a little out of time here. I want to still touch on a couple of things. You mentioned a little earlier, you know, about working online, collaboration and interactive whiteboards and things like that. I just want to have a little bit of a broader discussion about technology, how technology has evolved, particularly materials for construction. You mentioned your early fascination with the actual process of building as opposed to the process of design. How do you, and particularly in the context of the sort of global climate crisis and a lot of talk about sustainability, how has technology evolved to make what are we talking about when we talk about sustainable architecture? I suppose it's the kinds of environmentally friendly product materials one uses. Have you seen a shift both in the technology available and the use of that technology, particularly in a South African context? What is the discussion around sustainability in the context of building and design in South Africa?
I think there's two routes of sustainability. The one is sort of low-tech building construction technologies, which is kind of going back to the barefoot architect way of construction, which is what do you have around you? How do you make a building thermally efficient? How do you keep it warm in summer and cool in winter and create ventilation? The other is systems. And I think what the world has latched onto is systems, is building performance. So you see a lot of the sustainable buildings that are lauded for how good they are as sustainable buildings actually have a lot of glass in them and very little thermal mass. And they're all about the systems that they use, so the double or triple glazing or the, and it basically boils down, I think in South Africa, that the best way to describe it is, look at Rosebank at Sandton. Some of those buildings are considered to be the most sustainable buildings that we have in the country, but they are expensive, they're high in embodied energy, and the technology that's coming out it's not necessarily good for the earth as much as it is good for the building after its construction. And it's still this sort of push to have huge like buildings that are these phallic symbols of money, but still be considered sustainable. So I think there's a lot of sustainability washing, if you ask me, that's kind of going on. I think in the bigger constructions, which is where you need to really be able to be more sustainable, you're finding these systems that are coming into place, and people are just using systems as a way to circumvent the regulations around sustainability. whereas the real innovation, I think, is still yet to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of things that are, I think that there are globally, there are lots of architects that are now, I think it's becoming a more, there's a lot more sensitivity to the idea of sustainability. The same way I think that there are architects who are thinking a lot more socially, and it's the same ones that are doing it together.
Hmm.
You know, it's like I read an interesting article about Yasmin Lahri. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she's a Pakistani architect, an amazing architect.
Hmm.
No doubt just architect. She had an excellent career of some huge brutalist buildings, and now she's building mud huts in communities.
Mm.
So going back to the bare roots of architecture, one of the greatest architects arguably of our time.
Mm.
And she's building these huts and inventing sort of like beautiful coal stoves that she builds with the communities. And there's, I think that's the level of sustainability that some architects are going into. Like really talented architects are going into this sort of low-tech innovation of how is it that you can use less? How can you use less concrete? How can you build with what's around you? So there's the bigger push. And it's also becoming like as a result, because better people are using these low-tech technologies, it's becoming more fashionable. So it's really fashionable to have buildings built with rammed earth walls now.
Mm.
You know, it's like it's stylish and it's cool. So it's interesting. It's like in the sort of war between the systems and the low tech, there's this idea that like it's also quite trendy to have sustainable buildings that are truly sustainable.
Right.
But I think in terms of like the future of it is actually where I'm the most excited. It's just the things that we haven't done yet, and there are some interesting places that are doing things now. Like at MIT, there's a place called Mediated Matter Group, which is pushing the idea of new building materials. So how do you 3D print pectin, which is the stuff that you find in apple skins, as a building facade, which is completely biodegradable, waterproof, and then it's also just unbelievably beautiful to look at. So it's like there's those pushes. And I think that our low-tech sort of mindset that we have now, which is the obvious things of how to build sustainable buildings, once it meets something like that and this new technology of how to build new structures and more efficient structures, then we're going to start hitting a point where buildings will become truly sustainable.
Mm.
And because it will start competing in the market for the commercial spaces that the world seems to still be chasing after.
Yeah.
And I think once you can compete with that market and change that, then we'll really start to see a big push in sustainability. But there's a lot of stuff happening. It's just not happening at the pace that we're building in concrete. Because concrete's it's so easy to work with. It's familiar and it forms easily, and it's just this very usable thing. And concrete and steel, we've got so many systems that allow us to do it. It's sort of like ESCOM, you know, it's like asking the same question.
Mm-hmm.
Like how are we going to do renewable energies or alternative energy sources? And they're all there, but we still keep burning coal because we have all of the infrastructure to do it. And because it's familiar and because it has jobs in it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's that thing. It's like once you can start ticking those other boxes, then you'd really be able to push the technology that we see in coming out now.
Mm.
I'm quite hopeful about it. I think, you know, give it sort of another 10 years and, yeah, we might have a very different conversation.
Mm. On that positive note, Vedant, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for yours, Nick.
Great chatting to you. All the best over the next couple of weeks. We'll see you in Alex's garden, I suppose, once we're allowed to mingle again.
Absolutely, yeah. A couple of drinks will be in order then.
Take care.
You too. Cheers.
hope you enjoyed that. I liked his take on, you know, how many kind of future concepts, city concepts, design concepts in South Africa and Africa as a whole seem to be imposed using kind of European, dare I say, first world models and ideas, and really need to consider more the context in which they're happening, and particularly consider the people at whom they're aimed. It was nice to hear that he's quite excited about the possibility or impact, the possible impact of technology and new materials, new ways of thinking about design on architecture, on building a sustainable architecture in the future that moves beyond the greenwashed monoliths of current urban design around the world, it seems. Wash your hands, wear a mask, keep your distance, stay indoors as much as possible. Thanks again, Hindenburg, for their support. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting. It's practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information. Sign up for a free trial. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Deezer, Audio Boom, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.